more of a reason to tune in. Chaos.
That's the episode title. Chaos! Exclamation point.
Yeah, the Democratic primary is a chaos monkey.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk and we've got a lot to discuss today. First of all, tomorrow is Election Day and we're watching competitive races in a number of states. Second, Beto O'Rourke is out of the Democratic primary. After a lot of hype at the start of his run, why didn't things turn out so well for him? And then Elizabeth Warren has plateaued in national polls after months of steady increases. She also released her plan to fund Medicare for All last week, so we'll dig into that. And here with me to do all of that, our senior politics writer, Claire Malone. How's it going?
It's going well, Galen.
Happy Monday.
You too.
Also with us, managing editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
I'm very good.
And joining us from Kentucky is Perry Bacon Jr., senior writer. How are you doing, Perry?
Doing great, Chris.
You got a big election in your state tomorrow.
We do. This is, we're one of those rare states that has a really off-year election. So I won't miss the TV ads. That is not a cliche. If you live in a swing state or a state with an election, the candidates, I think, buy all the commercials during the football game. So I can describe to you the ads in great detail.
I can only imagine. Also, later in the show, we've got a new segment for you called Impeachment Data Point of the Week, or something along those lines. Maybe listeners can help us name it. So there's something to look forward to later on. Another thing to look forward to, we have some new merchandise at the 538 store, which is at 538.com/store. They created these new logo design things with a bunch of graphs and data.
You're really selling it, Galen.
I'm not purchasing until they get my Live Polls shirt out there.
They're also hoodies.
Please buy the shirts
now that it's cold.
And tote bags and hats.
And also, good news, we were off of ABC News Live for a little bit. We weren't recording the video version of our podcast because we were changing studios. We're now in our new studio, and we are back on ABC News Live on Tuesdays at 4:30. If you're watching this right now, you can see all of the cute knickknacks behind us. We've got some Lincoln logs, a mug,
I literally
a heart pillow.
I couldn't even describe some of this stuff.
Some straws.
That's troubling, actually.
What is that?
I don't know.
Exactly.
There's a name for it. It's like the helix ball or something.
Anyway, let's begin with Election Day, which is on Tuesday. Tomorrow, there are local elections all over the country in 39 states, to be exact. But in particular, we're focused on state-level elections in a few of those states, mainly the governor's races in Kentucky and Mississippi, and state legislative elections in Virginia. Now, election handicappers have the Kentucky governor's race rated either a toss-up or lean Republican, and the Mississippi governor's race as lean Republican, with polls showing a single-digit lead. The 538 partisan lead of Kentucky is 25 points more Republican than the national environment, and Mississippi 15 points more Republican than the nation. So, Perry, why are we seeing relatively close governor's races in such Republican states?
Well, first of all, as we wrote a lot in 2018, governor's races have not become as sort of aligned with party ID as, say, Senate races. Like, increasingly, if you look at a U.S. Senate race, just look at which party won for president, and you have a pretty good sense of who's going to win. Versus governor's races, you have the Larry Hogans, like in Maryland, who's a Republican. You have the Laura Kelly in Kansas, who's a Democrat. So the governor's races are a little less partisan overall. Also, particularly in Kentucky, Matt Bevin is the second or first, depending on what the latest morning consult data is, most unpopular governor in the country. He's a conservative Republican, but he's also like mock teachers. He's very caustic in terms of his rhetoric. He's just unpopular and maybe not very personally appealing. And I think that's dragging down his numbers and making this a closer race than it probably should be.
Do we expect that either in Mississippi or Kentucky, a Democrat could actually win for governor? Are we just surprised that these are close races?
So my look at the data suggests Mississippi, I'd be very, very surprised if the Democrat won. But here in Kentucky, I do think the polling has been there's not a lot of polling, and this is a big problem in all these state races, particularly in these red states. The newspapers are not very well funded and there's not a lot of polling, but I would not be surprised if Beshear won this race, just because less about Kentucky Kentucky just because Bevin is particularly unpopular and particularly disliked and has made it a close race. I still think Bevin's the favorite, but I would not be surprised at all tomorrow. And I think Bashir has a very good, you know, a very good chance of winning. He's not the favorite, but he's not a big underdog. You know, Trump versus Hillary Clinton 2016 is where I'd put it, something like that.
Claire, Virginia is the one state with legislative elections where it looks like control of the legislative body could actually flip. Republicans have very slim majorities in both the House of Delegates and the Senate at the moment. What do those elections tell us about the politics of Virginia right now?
If the Democrats win the House of Delegates, it'll be an entirely Democratic-controlled state. Virginia is an interesting state always because, as people are always obliged to point out, Northern Virginia is quite different from Southern, Southwestern Virginia. So it's sort of like the new South come into full bloom if Democrats will take full control of the state. But I think what people are largely pointing to with that House of Delegates election is it's a super off year, right? But how many Democrats feel engaged and will turn out? And I think people are seeing it a little bit as an enthusiasm test. But it is, you know, I think it's significant in the sense of Democrats have in the past, let's say 10 to 15 years, traditionally paid a little bit less attention to state houses. And that has been, I think, to the chagrin of many Democratic Party activists, especially under the Obama presidency. Obama himself kind of said, yeah, maybe I didn't do enough to build the party from the bottom up. So I think that's in some ways an important sort of example of the kinds of victories that Democrats typically don't pay as much attention to and Republicans did. And so perhaps it marks a new era of, okay, building blocks on the state level.
At the beginning of the year, there was a trio of scandals in Virginia. Yes. Regarding the governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general, with reports of two of them wearing blackface, and then the lieutenant governor himself, some accusations of sexual assault. And it was kind of the whole state was at a standstill for a second. Does it seem like any of that is actually playing into these races and making it harder for Democrats?
Well, they're not on the ballot. I mean, you know, the executive branch is not on the ballot, so in some ways, it's interesting that those two officials have, the governor and the lieutenant governor, are still in office. They both kind of rode those scandals out. But yeah, I mean, I think it just doesn't play a factor right now in those elections.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll have to wait a little bit and see. But Trump is also really unpopular there. Yeah. So even if the executives in Virginia are a drag on Democrats, then you have the executive of the country being a drag on
so they cancel each other out.
Republicans, maybe. I don't, you know, we'll have to say. What I'm interested in particular is, so we'll all wake up Wednesday and there will be like a plethora of takes about what all this means for 2020. And in particular, the gubernatorial races, there are some interesting dynamics there where you have a locally unpopular Republican trying to tie his moderate Democratic opponent to the national party, the Democrat trying to run on health care, trying to distance himself a little bit from impeachment. I would be very, you know, it's like the election is taking place in Kentucky and Mississippi. I would be very, very cautious when interpreting what the results say about 2020. If nothing else, maybe they'll just throw everything in a bucket and look at it all, right?
And we're actually going to have a reaction podcast Wednesday morning to those elections. So we'll have an opportunity to talk a lot more about those races once we have actual results. So tune in for that. But we're going to move on for now, since we have so much to discuss, and talk about the end of Beto O'Rourke's bid for the presidency. Now, if I recall, when he entered the race, we actually did an emergency podcast. You know, he had his Vanity Fair cover shoot. You know, people expected that he might be a front runner in this race. Perry, what happened?
I think I'm going to put a little blame on myself and people in the media, I think, and say that I thought that a Barack Obama-style persona-based candidate who wasn't particularly left or particularly centrist would do really well. I saw Beto as somebody who, his campaign in Texas went well. There seemed to be sort of a groundswell of people looking for him. He wasn't a Sanders type. He wasn't as old as Biden. I just thought he would do very well. And I know Pete Buttigieg has sort of taken some of that lane, but Buttigieg is pretty clearly in fourth place. The Democratic favorites right now are three people in their 70s, two pretty liberal people, one pretty moderate older person. So I think part of it is like, I'll put myself in this category, I may have misassessed the Democratic electorate and its desire for a Beto-style person. And I think that's the fundamental factor to me is we can talk about what he did or didn't do in his campaign, but my sense is maybe he wasn't that strong of a candidate from the start.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were decently skeptical of his Senate campaign. You know, we kind of always said he's probably not going to win, but he is. There was obviously a lot of enthusiasm. And I think the reason why he ended up getting into the race kind of boiled down to two factors. One, he showed a lot of fundraising prowess, and maybe that had to do a lot with Ted Cruz and people's dislike of Ted Cruz. But two, people saw him as, I guess, you know, this, I sort of group this kind of like older millennial, younger yuppie, whatever group of white guy politicians who sort of came of political age in the era of Obama, where they're trying to mimic Obama's style of soaring campaign rhetoric and all that stuff, while also being for the Trump age, kind of playing the identity politics of likable, nice white guy. Now, I think O'Rourke's campaign, I think people undersold how much people didn't like Ted Cruz in Texas and people nationally didn't like Ted Cruz. So he probably got a lot of fundraising dollars from that. But I think he was crowded out in the younger Biden lane, right? Like if you like Joe Biden's politics, but you don't want to vote for an older man, vote for me, Beto O'Rourke, or as has, you know, become apparent, me, Pete Buttigieg. Pete Buttigieg, you know, everyone talks about Buttigieg and O'Rourke were kind of competing for the young guy lane. I think what really stands out to me in sort of the wreckage of O'Rourke's campaign is that he probably organizationally wasn't fully prepared for a national campaign organization versus I remember talking to Pete Buttigieg in early 2017 when he was running for DNC chair and he already had kind of a big deal media person, right? Yeah. Like he was setting the stage, whereas O'Rourke wrote like soul-searching diary posts, which are sort of understandable on a human level, but organizationally, and you know, you want someone who's not waffling to get into a presidential run. And obviously, I think, you know, we can talk about the Vanity Fair cover and how much it maybe sort of really pushed things over the edge.
Turned him almost into the butt of a joke in some ways.
It was the whiplash quick reversal of media darling during the Senate campaign. And I think just, it's kind of rare that you can pinpoint exactly when a narrative or a tide turns against a candidate. And for O'Rourke, it's very pinpointable.
Micah, do you feel like the arc of Beto's political career over the past 2 years or so and how he ended up doing in the Democratic primary tells us something about the Democratic Party today in terms of, you know, what's viable, what's not, what's attractive, what isn't?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I think there are many explanations for O'Rourke's rise and fall that don't tell you that much. Like one explanation, which Claire was getting at, is just that the Beto shtick didn't play well on a national stage, right? That it in the context of a Texas Senate race, it didn't seem that odd that he would run for Senate. But once you get into a presidential race and you have this young white guy running against a big field that includes a lot of accomplished women, accomplished people of color, in the context of a Democratic primary, it just doesn't look as good. None of that was within his control, really, except deciding to run for president. But it just sort of like hit what he was selling in the context of the national stage just didn't look as good. I also wonder a little bit whether there are non-fundamental factors that maybe you could point to that if he had handled them a little bit better, maybe things would have gone differently. You know, when he first got into the race, he raised a ton of money. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bit there where the polls showed him not doing amazingly well, but, you know, in the high single digits, low double digits. So if Beto had, like, not gone on that soul-searching whatever, maybe, yeah. And...
Well, there's also, I mean, O'Rourke and Booker were kind of, to me, the most prominent examples of people, I mean, to use Booker's words, preaching the politics of love, right? The idea that we're trying to be Trump opponents, but in a nice way. And it hasn't really landed. And I think, to me, the last debate threw it into such stark relief where, I mean, I've been dinged for calling it the emergence of Mean Pete, but I think it's the most it's the most concise way of saying, I mean, Buttigieg really went after O'Rourke for being like
unrealistic,
squishy, unrealistic. Yeah, and you saw O'Rourke's in our tracking poll. You saw O'Rourke's numbers really go down after that, and I kind of attribute it to a couple of moments with Buttigieg just sort of, you know, cornering him into something.
And the opposite, Buttigieg has done better since.
Correct. Yeah.
Well, that's the other thing is, like, we can point to Vanity Fair. We can point to a couple sort of missteps, perhaps, on the O'Rourke campaign's part. But look, like, one other way to explain it is just Beto in Texas did really well with college-educated white voters, mm-hmm. right? There was a ton of competition in this field for college-educated white voters, and, like, not that many people can do well with one group. So I don't know. I'm not inclined to read that much.
One thing I saw Nate note after he dropped out of the race was, oh, it turns out this kind of like super woke cultural stance paired with a neoliberal economic worldview, there's just not much of a market for it. So is that too fine-tuned of a read on Beto O'Rourke not doing well? It could just be, okay, the field didn't work out for him.
Yeah. So yeah. So I tend to think, look, maybe you flip the coin flips a couple of times differently, and maybe he does better. Also, there was just a lot of competition. There is something though to the idea that if you are targeting like white liberals, okay, there's a lot of white liberals, white quote unquote woke liberals in the Democratic Party, right? If you were targeting moderate whites, there's also a ton of moderate whites in the Democratic Party. There's a ton of young voters in the Democratic Party. There's not a lot of young and white and moderate voters in the Democratic Party. And so the O'Rourke campaign kind of pivoted away from that a little bit, kind of halfway through. But Perry's written about this. That section, young and white and moderate, is just a really small part of the party as opposed to white and moderate.
Got it. And finally, just to wrap up here, Perry, it sounds like Beto O'Rourke has decided not to run for Senate again in Texas. Is that the right choice?
Yeah. I mean, I think based on just his campaign, he didn't do very well in the campaign. I think he's probably taken some positions that are probably to the left of where Texas is electorally. Also, I think one thing he was hinting at when he didn't want to run before is I do think the top of the ticket, he's not going to be running his own campaign like he was running in the Senate in 2018 where he could outrun the ticket. Like he did pretty well compared to other candidates nationally. I think his assessment is correct. His aides were hinting at this is that, you know, your results in a Senate race in a presidential year are pretty much driven or highly correlated to the top of the ticket. And so whether he ran or not, his sort of whatever his special sauce was in 2018 was not going to apply to 2020 anyway.
Well, that's an interesting thing to keep in mind when we look ahead to some of those Senate races in 2020. But let's move on to Elizabeth Warren and her plan to pay for Medicare for all. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Quip. What actually makes a better toothbrush? Industrial strength power, claims of miraculous trendy ingredients, multiple modes. If you ask your dentist, they'll tell you it's less about the brush and more about how you use it. That's why Quip was created by dentists and product designers to focus on what actually matters for your oral health, healthier habits. Quip's sensitive vibrations with a built-in timer guide gentle brushing for the dentist-recommended 2 minutes with 30-second pulses ensuring an even clean. Quip automatically delivers brush heads to you every 3 months for clean new bristles right on schedule. These thoughtful features make brushing something you actually want to do twice every day. Quip starts at just $25, and you'll get your first refill free at getquip.com/538. This is a simple way to start brushing better, but you have to go to getquip.com/538 to get your first refill free. Go right now to getquip.com/538. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start losing their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent more hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. This Black Friday, secure the best deal of all, a healthier, thicker hairline. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims was created by a guy who knows some men's health conversations are easier online in person, so there's no more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that is shipped directly to your door. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 today while supplies last and subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or pharmacy somewhere else. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. 4hims.com/538. We're back, and one of the defining features of the Democratic primary so far has been Elizabeth Warren's steady rise in the polls from the mid-single digits to eventually become a frontrunner in the race. Over the past month, though, she has either plateaued or declined, depending on which average you look at, and she's now polling in the low to mid-20s, the same as about a month ago. And this has happened as she's gotten increased pushback from her rivals on how she will pay for Medicare for All, which she spelled out in a plan that she released on Friday. So let's start here. Claire, what's the explanation for why Warren has plateaued where she is in the race right now, the low to mid-20s?
Well, I think it's in some ways the sort of natural breakdown in the primary. Warren has better numbers among Democratic voters as far as enthusiasm goes, but I think people are worried about her in quote-unquote electability areas, and that has to do with, I think, largely, although not limited to, her more progressive stances, particularly on healthcare and, let's say, wealth taxes. So I think, you know, seeing Warren and, I guess, nationally Biden, right, vying for things, there does seem to be, she's reached some kind of ceiling for now as far as people saying, okay, is she the one for sure I want? Strategically, this is who I want to send to the general election. And I do think that there are, she has good numbers when it comes to like second, she's someone's second choice, right? Like those, that she shows a pretty broad appeal there. But I think there's a little bit of a hang up as far as the numbers go for voters about whether or not they think in a general election, her policy platform will be as palatable to general election voters in, frankly, certain states.
Yeah. Since the most recent debate, a lot of the conversation surrounding Warren has been about healthcare.
Right.
You know, there's no real way that we can tell looking at the numbers if that's the reason that she's plateaued here. But is that a real challenge for her? Is that like a press invention? Or
I think it's not a press invention because, you know, Bernie Sanders, I think in some ways in 2017, laid the gauntlet down when he had his Senate Medicare for All bill, right, which every single Senate Democrat who ended up running for president signed on to, including Warren. And she's always said, I'm with Bernie's plan. I think what's been interesting to watch is how, you know, I'm not sure strategically if healthcare for the Democrats during this primary is necessarily the issue that you want to make the issue. I mean, I think in some ways the wealth issue, right, the wealth tax, that's a popular issue, taxing the rich. I mean, you know, Sanders talked, I feel like there was a lot more conversation about college plans in the last election. And it's really become, at least in the last couple of debates, it's felt like such a healthcare-centric thing. And that is the policy point upon which a lot of the Democrats disagree. And it's led to a lot of kind of, at times, extremely sharp-elbowed internecine conflict. So it's certainly a big issue. It's something that Democratic voters really turned out for in 2018. But it also reveals real rifts in the party.
So we discussed the politics of healthcare pretty recently. And Perry, I don't think you were with us for that discussion. But in general, we noted that, you know, polling shows Democrats' number one priority in terms of policies is healthcare, and that there's more public support for a public option than single payer. So Warren has now released this plan to pay for Medicare for All. She's sticking with Medicare for All. From looking at that plan, Perry, who do you think the audience is? What's the political calculation here?
The plan is explicit about not increasing middle class taxes. So, or like the way they've written it is like it's not a direct middle class tax increase. So the audience, I think, is to some extent voters concerned about electability and if Warren's going to take a stance that probably is going to be unpopular, middle class taxes would increase. Just to jump back briefly, we talk about why Warren has sort of peaked in the polls. I think one potential outcome is maybe her natural ceiling was 25 to 30 or something like that. Maybe she wasn't going to keep gaining just because she got the support. She kind of killed off, you know, she got the Kamala Harris support that she, because Kamala Harris has went down to basically zero. Warren, you know, Sanders is pretty stable now, but maybe Warren got her natural support. Another explanation is, like, Sanders, I sort of assumed, to be honest with you, the heart attack would be problematic for his campaign and his numbers would decline. And he's kind of bounced back, like, health-wise, but also he's got endorsements. He's doing well in New Hampshire. So I do think Sanders hasn't risen, but Sanders has sort of stayed where he is. And that's pretty helpful to him. And probably my guess is if he had declined to single digits, that would have helped Warren. And the third thing on this healthcare issue is, I don't think this is actually a real healthcare debate in which no one thinks Medicare for All is going to pass in 2021. Warren doesn't, neither does Joe Biden. So this is
don't tell the voters.
nor do the voters, I think. But I think what we're really talking about is Pete and Joe Biden can't say, I will win white guys in Michigan that won't vote for Warren, but they can say healthcare, she's unrealistic. So if you substitute electability for Medicare for All, then that would make every conversation more clear, because we're sort of, I think we're having a fake discussion about healthcare when we're having a real discussion about electability, and no one feels comfortable talking about, candidates can't talk about electability directly because it's sort of awkward, but in reality, this is what this Medicare for All is. It's like the question in the Democratic Party is, how risky, how aggressive, how sort of transformational can we be and still win the general election? And Warren and Sanders are saying pretty transformational. Biden and Pete are saying less transformational. And that's what we're really talking about here. And her healthcare plan addresses one issue in that it doesn't raise middle class taxes, but it creates another issue in that we're talking about $20 trillion in total spending that's being kind of rearranged. And Joe Biden and Pete are going to use that $20 billion number to make it seem as scary as possible over and over again.
Perry, I take your point about the healthcare being a stand-in for trying to talk about basically electability with white men in the Midwest. And I think that's partially right, although I don't want to fully... I mean, I struggle with this about like how much to essentially like gender-essentialize Elizabeth Warren's campaign, because I think it's a big component there. But I do also think with Warren and Sanders, there are, even if like, let's say, sophisticated voters and people in the media, even if everyone's kind of realistic about, listen, Medicare for All is not going to be the way the country does healthcare in the next 5 years, probably not in the next 10 years. I do think there's still a sense among people with Warren and Sanders that the kind of wholesale rewriting of foundational systems are scary, and the like reality of those things haven't fully been fleshed out for people. So I think some of it is definitely the identity politics of who appeals to specific voters in upper Midwestern states, for instance, who are men who Democrats need to win back because of the electoral college system. And some of that is like they don't want to vote for Elizabeth Warren because she's a woman, maybe. But I do think we can't underemphasize the fact that like healthcare and the wealth tax stuff is emblematic of, whoa, like, is this anti-American? Like, I don't think we should undersell that dynamic in the primary or in the election this year.
The other thing is like there's policy and then there's like policy as proxy for attitude. One way to look at the campaign so far is like, okay, Kamala Harris had a big surge after the first debate, got some scrutiny for healthcare, kind of bungled the response, and then went down in the polls. Warren, rising in the polls, starts to get some questions on how she's going to pay for healthcare, kind of bungles the response, waits a while to release a plan, starts to plateau in the polls. So maybe, I don't know, maybe voters are really attuned to healthcare. They're really looking at what the candidates say on it and holding them account for, like, if there are any holes in their answers. Or maybe it's just like there's a certain cycle to the media, and when it naturally goes to a negative cycle of attention, that tends to correspond with a downtick in a candidate support. Like, okay, Warren has now released a plan that avoids saying, I'm going to raise taxes on the middle class, because that position would be unpopular. The whole plan is unpopular, right? Medicare for All, taking away private insurance, is not popular. So how exactly are the politics working here? You get what I mean? Like, is Warren really saving herself support by not raising taxes on the middle class? My starting assumption is kind of what Perry said, which is like not so much that this was always Warren's ceiling, but that this was like the low-hanging fruit. She picked up a lot of the very liberal voters, a lot of the more liberal, somewhat liberal voters, and kind of this is where we are, and that healthcare doesn't have that much to do with it, honestly.
I do think if Warren does not win this primary, I will have the question of, there was a moment in July where I would argue it was pretty clear to me Medicare for everybody who wants it is obviously going to be more popular than Medicare for all. So Warren, if she really wants to win this thing, has a choice. Does she back down on this one issue, keep her other seven positions that are pretty left, concede that Sanders is going to be clearly to the left of her on this issue and try to win that way? Or does she try to match Sanders on leftwardism and then maybe be vulnerable to Pete and Biden attacking her the way they are now? I don't think this was an easy call. It was a hard call. I tend to think she made the wrong one electorally, but this was a defining moment in the campaign, and you're seeing how it played out now.
This is a great question of, like, if Warren had come out for Medicare for all who want it, what would have her support done? Clearly, the Warren campaign thought, okay, the best electoral thing is what Perry said, is we stay to the left. And look, she kept climbing in the polls long after they came out for that. So in some sense, I think they were proven, at least so far, right. She picked up during that time a lot of very liberal voters who maybe wouldn't have come on board if she had not stayed to the left. So Perry, maybe we disagree here on that. Healthcare, you know, polls show it's the most important issue, except for beating Trump, for Democratic voters, you know.
It's an interesting question, but I think basically what you guys are envisioning is an Elizabeth Warren campaign where she's running as Elizabeth Warren on all her sort of trademark issues that everyone kind of knows her for, kind of remaking the financial system. But on healthcare, she's basically running like a Pete Buttigieg-esque campaign in order to kind of compete with Biden on a practical level. And I understand what you guys are saying from the electoral strategic point of view, because, yeah, like, those plans are more popular. But I also think the one thing her campaign has done, I think largely to its credit, is have a pretty coherent ideology. And Warren's reputation is about systemic change, right?
It would have been weird.
It would have been discordant in some ways. And I think you could have seen this weird, what happened to Harris, frankly, which is like, you know, I am Dr. Frankensteining this campaign, and I'm going to like take a bit here and there. And we're going to build the perfect thing, but it turns out to be a monster, right? Like, and it kind of crashes and burns, which is what I think happened a little bit with Harris. So I don't know. I get what you mean from a strategic point of view, but I wonder if it would have kind of fallen flat on the, to use this word, authenticity front, right?
It's a hard question, but I do think it's worth noting the wealth tax in her increasing the rich and all those ideas about fighting the wealthy are very popular with Democrats and pretty popular by the Republicans with the general election. Mm-hmm. A wealth tax is not a bad position for your electability unless you're worried about losing donors on Wall Street, which is a problem, but that's different. The Medicare for all position is different in that Warren, you know, to her, she's a politician, and I would argue in general happens to have taken bold transformation stances that poll well. And even with Republicans, in this one instance, I would argue, I agree that it would have looked like a wimping out to have taken the P position. I do think in this, like, healthcare is different. Like, the Democrats lost the House in 94 because of healthcare. They lost the House in 2010 because of healthcare. I do think there's a healthcare amnesia. Like, I just think on healthcare was an issue where I would argue for her, she might look back and be like, if this was one she should have chosen.
Well, and of course, she's still very much in the race. She's still very much the second, you know, polling in second. And so this could all end up working out for her. We're going to see with time. But sorry, go ahead, Micah.
No, I was just going to say, but, you know, absolutely, she is polling in second. What I would say, though, is like the evidence that she has plateaued and maybe even fallen a little bit in the polls is pretty conclusive. Mm-hmm. Our quantitative, Laura Bonner calculated an average that adjusts for House effects as part of this other project. And it shows Warren at least plateauing and maybe dropping a little bit. So, like, there was a little bit of time there where I think a lot of people were calling her the front runner or co-front runner. And even at the time, that seemed like a little much. But now I think Biden has a clear lead on Warren.
Micah, I guess one question I would ask was, you were hinting that this is just about, is this about healthcare and Medicare, or is this about the scrutiny phase? Like, you were hinting before that kind of, like, now that Pete appears to be going up in some polls, I don't want to debate that too long, but is Pete now going to enter, is this about Warren and healthcare, or is this about any candidate who rises in the polls gets this kind of extra media scrutiny, and it's going to come to Pete next week, and he's going to have a similar problem? Or maybe it's about policing or what he's done in South Bend or something, but it's coming to
be about black voters.
Is this about Warren, or is this about just the media hits you hard when you're at the front and this is what happened to Warren?
It could be about, okay, it could be about healthcare. It could be about healthcare as a proxy for electability. It could be about just this was she got her low hanging fruit. This was always her kind of natural pause point. Or it could be about
media cycles.
Like, we do not know.
As we wrap up here, I do want to mention one poll. Last week, a New York Times Siena College poll came out from Iowa showing that Warren is leading there, so still leading. In fact, she had been doing pretty well in Iowa, but that Sanders and Buttigieg had gained ground, and so they're now both within 4 points. She's at 22, Sanders is at 19, Buttigieg at 18, and then Biden at 17. When we had talked about Warren's path to the nomination in the past, it looked like doing quite well in Iowa and New Hampshire, the first two states. If this becomes like a four-way race in Iowa, what does that mean for the trajectory of this primary race, Claire?
I mean, this is the question most...
Claire, answer that question.
This is the question most frequently asked, and it is the question to which it is hard to give a clear answer. But, I mean, I was at a wedding this weekend, and people were asking me this. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know who's going to win. But what I mean to say is this, which is, I think if it becomes this four-person race in Iowa and New Hampshire, it does throw things into a weird, chaotic period because voters like a winner, right? Voters are kind of simple in that way, right? If let's say the same person wins Iowa and New Hampshire, even if it's not Joe Biden, who might be the strategic choice that as many Democrats would want, then that person has, then, you know, the Warren or the Buttigieg who wins, let's say, Iowa and New Hampshire becomes all of a sudden like, hey, okay, I can stomach that person. Like, I think that it's much more of an open race right now. And you do start to see people's, like, the incredulity where people will say, like, whoa, Biden still has a chance because they've read a lot of, like, bad press about
that's
Biden.
That's crazy, yeah.
That is honestly the thing you hear the most often, like, if you live, I think, in a big urban area, is people really being surprised that, like, Biden is still very, very, very much in the race.
He's the favorite. What about this for a take? Okay. Buttigieg probably has to win Iowa.
Definitely. Yeah, I think so. But he's not in it, right?
Like, no, he could win Iowa.
Yeah, for sure.
Warren does not have to win Iowa. Does she have to win Iowa or New Hampshire?
Probably.
Yes, for sure.
And she's got to be, like, looking strong if she doesn't win Iowa, because Iowa is her best state out of the first four.
Yeah.
We can debate New Hampshire, but I think Sanders is strong there.
Yeah. She for sure has to win one of those. I mean, Buttigieg definitely does, right? Because, like, those white voters are, like, his people electorally.
And he also doesn't have the national numbers that the other candidates have, so he would have to do well in Iowa to get that, like, patina of being a winner and then increase
right,
his national poll.
He is still...
A la Jimmy Carter, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, because he is still being introduced. Like, I think that's, again, a thing to be reminded of. Pete Buttigieg is still... I think he's known, but I don't think he's well known. You know, more and more people will tune in, blah, 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 the same old lines. But there isn't as finely drawn sense of who he is yet.
I guess I would say I have a great amount of confusion. So the national polls say Biden is a very clear lead, but it's weird to be the front runner nationally and sort of clearly, but be, you know, he could very reasonably finish fourth in Iowa and third in New Hampshire. And so I assume that would change the national numbers if those things both happen. So that would make the national polls different. His black vote lead, I think, would be strong. Also, like, the gap between Pete being so strong in Iowa and so weak with black voters in South Carolina particularly. Those are sort of dynamics I don't think I recognize from previous campaigns. And the fact that Bernie and Warren are sort of in this similar kind of, you know, the lanes thing can be overdone. But I do think there are some voters who are going to be looking as the process goes farther. If you're a lefty person and Bernie's finish ahead of Warren in seven states, I'm guessing you might decide to choose Bernie because he can win and he's lefty too. So I am a little bit struck by, I don't have a lot of confident things to say here only because I don't like having the front runner running on his ability to win states could finish fourth in one and third in the next one is a weird dynamic.
Yeah,
the
I think
the young guy running as the next Obama who has no black support is a weird dynamic.
I think it's going to be interesting, Perry, to that very point. And I think we've talked a lot about this, which is like the order of operations of primary states makes a difference in the full, like we don't have a national primary, the order matters. I am kind of interested to see how campaigns spin this to the public. I mean, Biden's campaign has already done a certain amount of groundwork of saying, like, he doesn't need to win Iowa. He don't, like,
but fourth is different than not winning. But
he's gonna.
We don't need to win until June.
Exactly. That is most certainly a line coming out of Biden's campaign. I think it's gonna be interesting to see how is Buttigieg's campaign squaring the fact that, like, okay, these white people in the Midwest like him. Perhaps the people in the woods like him too in New Hampshire. But like, what about everyone else, right? Like, I think there could be an interesting dynamic here because more and more Democratic primary voters, perhaps American voters in general, are okay with the idea of institutional change in government, blah, blah, blah. I think you're going to be seeing a lot of like campaign operatives talking the primary system as a way to talk about their candidate appeal. You know, there's going to be, I think, a little bit more of spin percolating through the system here, aimed towards voters to say, like, well, the system is kind of weird here, but our guy is still the best guy for blah, blah, blah reasons.
No, totally. And, like, look, the mess in Iowa, I think, confusion is absolutely the right response to that. Because it's sequential, as Claire said, the mess in Iowa just adds uncertainty to everything. But look, like, the more it's a mess in Iowa, then maybe like Biden could win Iowa with like 22% of the vote,
that's
right?
Certainly true. Yeah.
And then what happens, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that helps him a lot.
So that's good. Yeah. How does winning a state affect the race?
wins the primary. That's my question. But yeah.
As you can tell here, it means that, I guess this is all kind of good for us. At least
this is the last you'll hear us talk about it ever.
More of a reason to tune in. Chaos.
That's the episode title. Chaos! Exclamation point.
Yeah, the Democratic primary is a chaos monkey.
Let's wrap with our new segment on impeachment. And before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Honey. Giving holiday gifts is great. Overspending on all those gifts is definitely not. So why spend more than you have to? Finding the lowest price is easy if you have Honey. Honey is a free browser extension that automatically finds the best promo codes whenever you shop online. This means you always get the best deals without even trying on over 20,000 sites like Amazon, eBay, J.Crew, Sephora, Expedia, Target, Best Buy, and more. Honey has found its over 10 million members $1 billion in savings, and Honey has over 100,000 five-star reviews on the Google Chrome Store. If you're buying gifts this holiday season, then you need Honey. If you're not, you probably know someone who is, so do them a solid and tell them about Honey. Honey can help make sure that you're getting the best price for whatever you're buying. It's free to use and installs in just two clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/538. That's joinhoney.com/538. We're back, and we're going to be talking about impeachment plenty over the next couple months. So from time to time, we're thinking of spotlighting a telling data point in the news. And for now, we'll call this impeachment data point of the week. But listeners, again, if you have a better idea for what to call this, you know how to get in touch with us. And our impeachment data point for this week is 232 to 196. That is how the vote broke down last week on the impeachment resolution, laying out the rules for the public part of the inquiry. Perry, what is the significance of that data point, 232 to 196? What does it tell us about the politics of impeachment?
It just tells us a lot of things we sort of already knew, but we're in a more partisan environment than even 1998-99, which is a very partisan environment. You basically had, you have a lot of evidence that Trump did some not great things involving Ukraine that you could assume that maybe should be investigated. Like, but I think what I saw was, the Republicans treated the, should we have an impeach, I guess everybody to be fair, all the politicians I think treated, should we have an impeachment investigation as, should Trump be impeached? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is the, and that's the vote we got basically. I think the Republican members probably felt correctly that if they voted for the impeachment inquiry, Trump would attack them on Twitter, they could be challenged in primaries, and that affected the results, I think. You could imagine a world in which impeachment inquiry and impeachment are not the same question, and that was not at all what we saw last week.
So I must remember we had that debate on the podcast about what the political strategy Republicans would employ. It's almost like I was right in that debate and that they would hold the line at all costs.
Look at you. And to clarify, there were two lawmakers who broke ranks. It was two Democrats who voted against the inquiry. All Republicans voted against the inquiry. I mean, should we just assume now that that's what the final vote is going to be in the House?
I think that should be the strong starting assumption, and then you just wait for strong evidence to the contrary. You saw a little bit of reporting that there were some Republicans who could vote on the substance, articles of impeachment, differently. I think we all have reason to be very, very skeptical of that.
Maybe I can see a world in which maybe a Democrat or two looks at the polling in their district, and maybe it shows that impeachment, if you're in maybe one of these particularly red or, you know, Trump districts, maybe you sort of say, oh, the investigation was strong, impeachment is too divisive. I think it's more likely you'll see a Democrat or two flip to voting against impeachment. I don't think any Republicans are going to vote for it. I think that's like, that ship has sailed.
Perry and I talked about this for an article we were working on before the vote, and Perry predicted the vote almost perfectly. I was a little surprised Republican members who had announced that they were retiring, that there weren't any defections there.
So what's the reason for that? Like Will Hurd, for example, he could have voted for the inquiry. He's retiring. He's pretty moderate. I mean, he's one of the three lawmakers who's in a district that Hillary Clinton won, remaining Republicans who's in a district that Hillary Clinton won. Like why didn't he?
I had a fairly cynical theory that was implied in the article, and I'll give it more directly now, which is that if you're Will Hurd, you want to work at Defense Yes. Contractor X and make a lot of money after this. I'm being very cynical here, but I happen to think if you're a Republican, you want to join a lobbying firm, you want to make a lot of money after this, you have to assume that sticking with your side is useful for that. Trump might win a second term, and then it's really useful for that. So I don't want to say they put money over conscience or what have you, because I think they might be conflicted on the issues too. But I do think there's incentives to sort of stick with the team, even if you're not necessarily leaving Congress. Like, I think it was a vote over, like, whether Trump should have said AOC should go back to her country, then I think Will Hurd might vote differently. But I think a pure vote on, like, basically, should Trump be president? Is he fit for president? I can imagine Will Hurd has some incentives to vote against that kind of vote.
On the flip side, you had Democrats in pretty red districts that are 15 or so points more Republican than the country as a whole, according to our partisan lean, who still voted with the Democratic Party line to open the impeachment inquiry. Why didn't we see more Democrats just hedging their bets, especially this close to an election?
Well, they still have room to hedge their bets. The two-tiered nature of the vote gives them kind of some political cover. Polling-wise, opening an impeachment hearing is decently popular. Voting for impeachment is not as popular. And so those people still have a way to say, listen, I felt that we should investigate the president. I thought we should look into this. Once I was presented with the evidence and weighed it, I decided not to vote for impeachment. They have a couple months to, you know, stick their finger in the air and see which way the wind is blowing in their district. And I think Pelosi knows that and probably has, you know, accounted for a little bit of a cushion within that caucus's votes.
This vote also now marks the beginning of the public portion of this inquiry. I think as soon as next week they could start having public hearings. Do we expect that public hearings are going to change public opinion?
I think
I don't. I tend to think. Sorry, go ahead, Micah.
Wait, I love how consistent Perry is.
No,
he's like, no one's going to flip. Public hearings won't matter.
That and Perry's right that that's probably the safest assumption. I do think that there is some polling that shows that. So okay, Democrats think what Trump did on Ukraine is horrible and want to impeach him. Right, put Democrats aside for a second. Everybody else is more lukewarm on impeachment, but they are pretty split on the actual substance of what Trump did. And so I think if you have weeks and weeks of, let's for the sake of Democrats' argument, let's say well-coordinated hearings and messaging hammering away at multiple instances of a quid pro quo, and I do think there's room there. Not for like, you're not going to see Republicans wholesale become pro-impeachment. But what if, you know, independents who are like 50-50 right now or thereabouts, what if they get to 60-40 for impeachment? You know, that makes a difference, I think.
Yeah. To me, it's not about congressional Republicans changing their votes. The televised hearings are about the potential to either suppress the votes of Republicans who were reluctant Trump voters, right? Or to, yes, convince those independent voters that, like, yeah, maybe I should vote for, again, I think it's contingent on who wins the Democratic primary, but maybe I should consider voting for the Democratic nominee if it's someone more moderate. But I think, you know, it's not going to change. Trump will likely be impeached in the House and will likely be acquitted in the Senate. But I think it becomes a factor in the general election, certainly, about, you know, being a not just a character test of Trump, because obviously that has been something that failed right in the last election. That's what Clinton tried to make the last election about, a character test of Trump. But I do think the idea that, you know, if people see him as being unpatriotic, abusing of power, corrupt.
If it's a national security story.
Yeah. Then I think there are threads that could be convincing to those swing voters.
All right. Of course, we will see what happens. And if listeners see any impeachment data points throughout the coming weeks or so, and you'd like to hear us discuss them, send them my way, and we will discuss it here. That's it for now. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
And thank you, Perry.
Thanks, Galen.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlow. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.